Welcome to the Book Tokyo podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McDewling, and we're across from Stephanie Bishop, who's come in to talk about the new novel, Man Out of Time. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I've had a copy of Man Out of Time for some time, and I've been reading it. I need... This is the book that is challenging my brain, my idea of... what do we call it? We don't call it madness, we call it disorder, perception, reality, love, relationships, family relationships.
Memory.
What are you doing? What are you doing to me?
Your whole world is disintegrating. Good.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished. No. I mean, in all seriousness, I was trying to think about how to convey that sense of breakdown in which all those parts of your world start to collapse without naming it as a mental illness, without pathologizing it, without committing the character to, without having the character feeling that they have committed themselves to a medical narrative. So yes, they don't know what's happening to them. So I'm very flattered that you didn't know what was happening to you either in the process of experiencing
that character. I just sent you the bills.
Yeah. Although his treatment obviously wasn't terribly effective, so, you know, yeah.
I mean, it feels really personal too. Is that just your novelist art messing with me, or is there are there bits in there that you've taken from your own life?
And part of it is novelist's art. I wanted it to feel like something quite intimate. And it took a very long time in the writing. Technically, this is actually the second novel that I started. I'd been working on it for about 10 years on and off, and it's fallen apart a number of times. I actually finished it before The Other Side of the World as a draft and then abandoned it because it was just dreadful. That version bears pretty much no resemblance to this finished one, but the idea behind it was similar. I should probably say something about what the book is about to explain.
You've done this podcast thing before.
I was like, people
this
listening.
Is exactly when Sarah jumps in and goes, John, you're an idiot. You never tell anyone what the book's about.
The book opens in September 2001 when Leon, Stella's father, has disappeared, and Stella, who is in her early 20s at that point, is approached for questioning as part of the investigation into her father's disappearance. She is very reluctant to answer the questions that the police officer puts to her, and there is the suggestion that she has some knowledge about his disappearance that she's deliberately withholding. And the novel then pans back to their earlier relationship between her and her father around 1987 when she's nine. And he is in the midst of the early stages of a breakdown in the aftermath of his brother's suicide. She, as a child, doesn't really know what is going on, doesn't understand what's happening, and the novel kind of moves forwards through her childhood and their intensifying relationship as he goes through a quite severe process of breakdown. The novel moves back and forward between her childhood and adolescence and the investigation that's underway in the near present, and then eventually, as their relationship intensifies and Stella ends up in a situation of genuine danger, eventually the past narrative catches up with the present and we enter into the thick of that aftermath of Leon's disappearance. And eventually find out, you know, what happened to him. In terms of the background of the book, there is a personal aspect to it, in that my father had very severe depression and I watched him struggle with that. As a child, I suppose this is what I bequeath to Stella, in that she doesn't know what's going on because she's a child, and you internalize those experiences, then that's your environment, you normalize that. And it's not until she becomes, you know, quite a lot older that she can look back and understand or think back through that experience, which is partly my incentive in thinking about the book, in trying to write the book, was to try and look back at certain emotional experiences that I had in relation to my father and to try and unpack those a bit. So the book is in no way a biographical account of that. I can't call it an episode because, you know, that was just, it was a long period. There is a quote in one of Virginia Woolf's late diaries where she describes the way in which you never have the whole emotion of something at the time, that you only fill out an emotion in retrospect, that it continues to grow after the event has ceased to happen. And that was really, I suppose, kind of the ethos or motto of the book while I was writing, was to think back through experiences and magnify those 1,000-fold in the space of fiction, and to use fiction as a way of expanding an emotion, of enlarging it, of putting it in a new context, of changing this scenario, but all the time trying to kind of approximate an emotional truth, even if the events of the narrative bear very little resemblance to my own life.
Okay. And within that, so we're seeing things through Stella's eyes a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So there's a distortion, there's these points of distortion that come in. One thing that comes across is, you talked about there, is that perspective of childhood and the acceptance of childhood, that these have got to normalize these things. But also I get the selfishness of the perspective of a child.
Absolutely. It's total narcissist, yeah. Child, by definition. Yeah. That everything is their fault, but also everything is there for them. But so it kind of works both ways. In that she blames herself often, or quite easily, for things that go wrong because the universe is hers because she is a child. Yeah, absolutely.
And how do you balance, as a novelist, the lines of telling? So this is a very complicated construction of a novel. If people are picking you up expecting James Patterson, they're not going to get it.
No. That development happened quite slowly, in that originally in some of the early drafts, it was by and large all in Stella's perspective. And this wasn't working for me in terms of what I wanted the novel to do, because, well, her perspective, like Leon's, is warped. Hers by her childhood and the fact that she can't actually get outside her own head to understand what's going on within her family. And Leon's is warped by the fact that he's in the midst of, you know, breakdown, if not episodes of psychosis. It happened really by accident and an experiment where I realized it couldn't be chronological entirely, because that didn't reflect the experiences of the characters, where they were trying to put things together and trying to make sense of disorder that wouldn't have been true to their experience. And it had to have everyone's take on the events, Stella's, her father's Leon, her mother Frances. It had to have all of their internal spaces, because none of them would agree on what had happened. Mm. To have only one character would be to assume that there was one story and one line of truth and one experience, when in fact none of them would believe that the same thing. They all think something different is happening in their family, and for different reasons.
Well, you've got the spouse perspective and their relationship they've had together.
Yes.
And what it means for them, why they're together, and all those sort of things layered on top of that. And then the concern is of a mother for daughter. Yeah. And then also for husband as patient. Just in the one character, you've got all these different things going on. But then when you've got the older Stella looking back, there's that sense of detachment that we get when thinking about parents. Even as adults, it's never going to be the thing that all of us want.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, I suppose what I wanted to do with Stella in that later part of the book, when she is an adult, is to have her understand that she was effectively relating to her parents as fictions, that she was constructing them as fictions, and to understand that she would only ever really know them as her own fictional versions of parent figures.
You're messing with me here now. This is like the Tempest now. Because I'm going,
I don't know anyone.
But you're writing a fiction about your parent. Oh my God.
Well, I suppose that the consequence for Stella is that she loses faith in any coherent narrative.
Mm.
And so the book had to reflect that.
Which then made it much more difficult for a novelist to plonk that down. And then also to engage everyone in that. Yeah. So there's that balancing act, because you come across, you talk about Virginia Woolf, you talk about the modernists and a lot of the experimentation that went on. The risk they always had was, am I losing?
Exactly.
Is the book being put down? Yeah, can I tell my story and get them to the end of it without losing them? And, you know, with so many of the great works that people say, you must read it, and you go on and read it, and you're like, what the f*** is going on here? You know, I have no idea.
Yeah.
How am I going to complete this? Yeah. How do you keep an eye on that aspect as a novelist?
It's partly giving the book to other people to read to tell me when it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So...
But what does that mean?
Because what does that mean?
Because you're achieving what you want to achieve, and you're getting...
I think it's... I guess in the earlier stages of working that out, it's reading my work as a critic. It's really putting all of my aesthetic intentions aside and forgetting that I actually wrote it and criticizing the shit out of it. and you have to... I feel like I really have to be able to move quite quickly and in a very committed fashion between having no critical brain at all and just doing something entirely intuitive and then being, you know, a super arch critic and slamming the thing. And I suppose that's how you figure it. You know when something is suspenseful and you know when it's not. And when it's not, I guess I'd like to think that this holds it together. But when it's not, you have to, you know, you go back and fix it.
So what if you're the needs of your story and the art that you're working with and led you away? Like you've got a contract looming, you've got a book to publish, there's people out there who want to make money out of you. And your art is leading you away from the dollar. Yeah. So what you're in your room, you've gone, that is perfect, no one's gonna read it. Like how do you change that? How do you bring that back?
Maybe you don't. I mean, I don't know. Maybe you say, fine, don't make money out of me. I've got a day job and it's exhausting and I do that. I mean, that's truly, I mean, why I have a day job.
Yeah, well, this is really important to me, because I'm really sort of thinking about a lot.
Yeah.
About the integrity of the art, the idea. And you look at someone.
You have to write the book that you have to write.
Look, I had a contract for this book. The description of the project that I had the contract for, it in no way resembles the book. It is nothing like it.
Authors, God.
Well, I mean, I suppose the contract was a very good safety net in that it let me write something that maybe would not have been offered a contract otherwise. I don't know. I haven't had that conversation. I wouldn't swear by it. You do have to just write the thing you really, really have to write. And I, you know, I very many times almost didn't finish or stop, you know, thought I would stop trying to write this book. I suppose my writing process is that each day I will sit down quite early in the morning and I will have a word count. I may or may not get there, but I don't know what I will write in that space otherwise. And if I was to start to dictate what I had to do in those few hours, there would just be no point. I would be miserable. So if it's not commercially viable, if it's not going to make me money, that's fine.
Because it is what you...
That's what you have to do. Like, I could not function if I felt like I was doing... I don't actually think I could do something for money like that, even if I had, you know, I just...
We've had some incredible reviews, like that already. Like, this is before the book's even out there in the world, where people are just going, you know, this has messed with me in different ways and I don't know how to really talk about it. Like, this is what the reviews are saying. Like, I don't know. This is brilliant. I don't know... I don't know how to talk about it.
you leave people really discombobulated, and this is what I wanted to ask. And it's hard, like, I feel like there's no chance to speak because everything that everyone's saying is so amazing. And I'm like in a game of tennis, like just looking back and forth between you guys. But I just wanted to ask, and when I was reading the book, this is the question that keep coming up for me, is that when you write a book like Man Out of Time that's kind of designed to unravel the reader and like lose their sense of self, what does that do to you? Like, how do you, because I don't see how you could write it without sort of doing it to yourself in the process.
That's a valid question. I think you do it to yourself in the process, really. It was phenomenally difficult to write. But to be honest, I'm not really interested in things that aren't phenomenally difficult. I get bored. I have an extraordinarily low boredom threshold, and I can't sit still, which is a very bad combination for a novelist. No, I mean, it's funny. I was saying this to someone else. I guess there's two parts to that. One is that when I look back, I can't even remember writing it. But then when I put that in context, I think I can't remember what I did last Wednesday or what I ate for breakfast this morning. So maybe that's not actually unusual. But yeah, there was...
You remember the Virginia Woolf quote.
Yeah. I remember the Virginia... I remember the things that... No, well, like... But there was a sense of I would go into that space and, you know, I've got a job and kids and other stuff. So it's sort of like, okay, this is what I'm doing now. And it's... Everything else disappears. But I think... You come out of that and it's so intense you can't remember being there. It was a hard book to carry, though. You know, it was a very hard book to carry. And I really had to finish it for that reason, because I needed to move on and do something different with my life.
It sounds as though you so strongly had to compartmentalise just to write it that it's the experience of writing it is locked away.
I don't know if it's compartmentalising or not. Maybe it's just... I'm actually terrible at compartmentalising. I prefer things to bleed together so everything is just a kind of crazy mess and then you've got lots to write about. No, it's not so much that I can't... It's not so much that it was a case of compartmentalising, but that it was totalising everything. It infected everything. Everything absorbed... It absorbed everything.
So there's no one
experience
of writing the book to remember.
It's no, it's just your whole life.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting.
But you paused. You paused and wrote a whole other novel. And then all the stuff around doing a whole other novel.
Oh, yeah, because this was 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I was writing PhD at the time. So I would write a version, the first version of this very early in the morning and then, you know, go for a run and do my PhD. It was really stupid, but it's what you do when you're younger. And then I had a baby. So I put it aside then and did The Other Side of the World. And then it was just something that every time I wrote the same material would come up. And eventually it just became very clear that that was the material. It wasn't going to go away. I had to do something with it because it would stay there and I wouldn't move past it.
And so we have Man Out
of Time.
Stephanie, thank you so much for coming and talking to us. It's been marvellous.
Thanks for having me.
And you can get hold of Stephanie's books on booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.